everyone, and welcome to episode 78 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Sobolski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. The medieval period is an absolutely wonderful time to play in and to learn about. It's the root of a lot of the systems and traditions that we have in place today, and there are endless medieval stories from which we can pull wisdom and humor and inspiration. But like so many things, medieval history can be taken and twisted and used as a weapon against our fellow human beings. We've seen this with medieval history countless times in recent years, from Norse symbols being appropriated by neo-Nazis to people enacting violence in the name of a reimagined crusade. Not only are these uses of the medieval period vile, but they're not even accurate. They're built on a layered and intentionally constructed web of myths. How does this happen? And more importantly, what can we do about it? Dr. Amy S. Kaufman and Dr. Paul B. Sturdivant are the authors of The Devil's Historians, How Modern Extremists Abuse the Medieval Past, a book which examines the ways in which medieval history has been co-opted and constructed by extremists to suit their intolerance. Amy is an independent scholar and the author of numerous articles on medievalism, pop culture, and extremism. Paul is a visiting research specialist at the Smithsonian Institution, the author of The Middle Ages in Popular Imagination, Memory, Film, and Medievalism, and he's also the editor-in-chief of The Public Medievalist, a website which posts articles by academics for a mainstream readership. Both Amy and Paul have written important articles about medievalism and intolerance for The Public Medievalist, and they're here today to talk about how we got to this point, how the Middle Ages is co-opted and abused by extremists, and what we can do when we see our favorite time period being used to cause harm. Well, thank you, Amy and Paul, for joining me to talk about your new book, The Devil's Historians. It's a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having us,
yeah.
It's great. I've been following your work for ages on The Public Medievalist, so I was happy to see that you have a book coming out. So let's get straight into it. The Devil's Historians, what is this book about?
So The Devil's Historians is about all of the ways in which people have used the Middle Ages to promote hatred and violence against other people. For centuries, people have used the Middle Ages to justify horrible things, racism, sexism, colonialism, imperialism, even things like murder, terrorism, and genocide. And we call in the book the people who do that the Devil's Historians. And we call them historians specifically because they are using the Middle Ages. But they're using a Middle Ages that is their own twisted and warped version of the Middle Ages, a Middle Ages that a medievalist wouldn't really recognize. It is an idea of the Middle Ages that is all white, that is one that is marked by untrammeled violence, and one where white Christian men rule everything. And those people who are using the Middle Ages for these ill purposes are ones who generally speaking feel that we should be returning to that idea of the Middle Ages, that fantastical idea of the Middle Ages today.
I was also going to add that we wanted to break down where some of those myths come from and why they're used. So we try to go over some of the most common misconceptions about the Middle Ages, that everyone was dirty, that everyone was Christian, that it's Eurocentric, that people were super religious, because a lot of times the extremists who use the Middle Ages and who want to return to it don't really study the actual past. They study a distorted version of the past that they see in popular culture and sometimes get in the classroom and sometimes get from translation. And there are all different ways that this image of the past that, as Paul said, medieval scholars don't recognize makes its way into popular culture. So we wanted to look at those myths. We wanted to break them down. And in a lot of cases, we wanted to trace the lineage of extremism and how it uses the past. For instance, you can trace the way that the modern day alt-right shows up in the streets, you know, with swords and shields back to Nazi Germany and the way that they use the Middle Ages. And before that, the Ku Klux Klan and the way they use the Middle Ages. So a lot of times these extremists are nested, their ideologies and their approach to the past are nested, and they kind of grow that way.
That was a part that I thought was really interesting in the book, where sometimes people are accidentally, when they're looking into Norse mythology especially, they're accidentally stumbling over some Nazi propaganda. So how did that happen? Can you walk us through how the Nazis kind of took that over to the point at which we can accidentally come across that in just trying to research it ourselves?
Sure, but it's a long story. It starts long before Nazi Germany with kind of European nationalism, where Europe, as nations solidified in Europe, and as they struggled with things like colonialism and identity, they looked to the Middle Ages as a kind of origin story for their different European nations, not always European, but that's mostly what we focus on in the book. So Germany, for instance, was not a unified country. And when the Grimm brothers, in the time that the Grimm brothers were writing, they were interested in sort of creating a history for the German people, like not necessarily the land borders, but the people within, trying to identify a particular spirit. And they went back to the Middle Ages to find that. So you'll see a lot of poetry and music and even scholarship about folklore, scholarship about literature and history that attempts to identify some kind of national origin in the Middle Ages. It happens in England, it happens in Germany, it happens in France, it happens in Spain in a lot of mistaken ways. Well, all of them are a lot of mistaken ways because they're looking for a beginning in a time that we traditionally conceive of as the middle, right? As a time between two times. So the Nazis really drew on that when they wanted to create their own version of the German state. And they focused very much on the whiteness of that nationalism. They didn't make that up, though. The nationalists who are writing in the 18th and 19th centuries are also much more gently, but still white supremacist, right? Because as they're trying to identify what's so great about being German, for instance, they're contrasting themselves with all the other cultures, right? And they're looking at things like Germanic literature, but also Norse literature and trying to find connections there. So when the Nazis pick it up, there's already 150 years of scholarship, both authentic scholarship and sort of aspirational scholarship about what it means to be German. And the Nazis just really amplify that. And Paul, I don't know if you want to pick up on some of the specifics of what they did.
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things that the Nazi regime particularly, they really focused their efforts on the now absolutely debunked idea of Aryanism, the idea that there is this sort of Indo-European Aryan race that is the, you know, the pure, quote unquote, white race that has existed through all time, and that through their kind of fantasies of history, they imagined to be the driving force for just about every major cultural innovation that exists. And so, for example, some of your listeners may not be aware, but the Nazis had a crack archaeology team. Which is not completely vastly different from what you'd see in something like Indiana Jones, for example.
Yeah, exactly. You think of, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Nazis looking for the Holy Grail. Why the hell did the Nazis want the Holy Grail? Well, the Nazis want the Holy Grail because they want to find a way to either fabricate or twist the evidence to say that all important historical discoveries were made by white people. It's not because the Ark of the Covenant is some mystical weapon that they will be able to use against the Allies, although there were some people who in the Nazi regime who seemed to believe in mysticism like that. But it was about forging an identity for themselves that goes back into history, and that the weapon that they were using was history itself. And so this crack archaeology team were traveling all over Europe, fabricating evidence wherever they could find it. And they were also some of the ones who were trying to forge these links between Germanic and Nordic people, which is where you get this obsession with Norse mythology and Viking mythology. That having been said, one of the things that you'll see with fascists then and fascists now is that there is this effort to sort of throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. And so the Nazis were Christians, except for when they weren't. And the Nazis were into Norse mysticism and mythology, except for when they weren't. And they were into destroying the sort of lionization of the Roman Empire in favor of the medieval, except for when they weren't. And so individual Nazis, you can see having kind of a more or less consistent through line in terms of their thinking about history, mythology, identity, past, present. But collectively, it's really about whiteness and it's about power.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll also add, you know, the Nazis located power in the Middle Ages, but with both the European nationalists and the Nazis, there's also a kind of narrative of corruption in that they believed that the Middle Ages held the simplest and purest spirit of the German people and that everything that came since corrupted that spirit, right? So they saw themselves as engaging in a kind of German recovery project to bring it all back together. And I think you can still see that narrative when you're looking at contemporary neo-Nazis and the alt-right and the far-right.
Yeah.
One of the best definitions I've ever heard for fascism is simply that they are parthenogenic ultra-nationalists. And I'll define what that means. Parthenogenic is people who are believing themselves to be the rebirth of something, the rebirth of a nation, of a spirit, of something. And so the Nazis were thinking of themselves, this is where they get the idea of the Third Reich, of this rebirth of something for them medieval, and where you can then connect that with Make America Great Again.
Yes. Yes, and I do want to come back to the idea of kind of the pure medieval hero, and that tends to be the Viking when you're looking at this. You're looking at protests or online white nationalists, they're looking at a Viking as being the hero. Tell us how the Vikings were actually really, really different from the stereotype that you see at these protests. What were the Vikings actually like?
Well, they bathed. An English chronicler, I can't remember the name, John of Wallingford, I think, maybe, complains about how much they bathed and how women were attracted to them. And they traveled, right? They traveled much further and wider and traded with cultures that were not simply England or Ireland or the typical places that you think of. They had contact with other faiths, other races, all kinds of other people. So that's one way in which they're different. Well, two ways if you count the bathing.
That's an important one, though.
Yeah.
But the Vikings weren't all warriors either, were they? What did you want to say, Paul?
Vikings is kind of a misnomer, which scholars will tell you. It's a retroactive term used to describe Scandinavian cultures that would raid in the summer when the water was warm, right? Which is when, obviously, you would go raiding. But that was a very specific class of people, right? It wasn't everyone. Most people were farmers, and that's the very unglamorous truth. And as we say in the book, you know, when people fantasize about being someone medieval, they don't often fantasize about being a farmer or a peasant or whatnot. They fantasize about swinging a sword, you know, something powerful.
And one of the things also that's really interesting about the Norse, the Vikings, if you want to call them that, is that they were incredibly culturally adaptive in a way that that white supremacists aren't or fantasize about them not being, that there's this idea of cultural, racial purity. The Vikings, they certainly went and raided a number of places. They traded with people. They conquered and they colonized a number of places. But when they conquered and colonized, it's quite remarkable in terms of the amount of cultural integration that you see. So, for example, they conquered more or less the entirety of the north of France because the French king became so frustrated with their raids that he effectively turned to one of their leaders and said, "If I give you the entire north of France, will you please stop?" And he says, "Yeah, sure, I'll do that." I think it was Rollo. But the thing about that is that within a generation, it seems as if their unique cultural identity is more or less gone and has been, and they have become Norman. And that flies in the face of the white supremacist idea of this strong, perpetual culture that never goes away, is that they were happy to become Norman. And the same thing happened when they conquered Sicily, effectively. I mean, they got around and they did conquer Sicily. And when they conquered Sicily, within a generation, they became indistinguishable from other Sicilians and were cooperating and working together with the local Greek population and the local Muslim populations that existed on the Isle of Sicily. So they were happy to work with people who were not like them and to become culturally something else.
Yeah.
And it's also important to point out that, you know, what we now call Vikings, they didn't think of themselves as a singular unified people, yeah. Right? I mean, they were members of different cultures under different rulers. Some of them were under kings, and some of them in Iceland were super obsessed with the law, right? And had more of a communal way of thinking about things. They had all kinds of different cultural modes and all kinds of different identifications. If you read Norse sagas, some of them are bloody, sure, and sexy, and all the things that we associate with Vikings in popular culture. But some of them, so like Njal's saga, is all about like big meetings to make rules about farmland, you know, and law and divorce and conversion and all kinds of things that we, intellectual things, right, and political things that we don't in popular culture associate with what we call Vikings.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to pull that out one because I think it is a symbol, you know, and it's wrong in so many ways, you know, with horned helmets and everything. But these Vikings that people kind of idolize, they never existed. They were not interested in the things that these white supremacists are actually interested in. And I just wanted to get you guys to work through that a little bit for us. Of course, you get into it a lot more in the book and on The Public Medievalist. Now, another thing that you get at in the book is how much people lean on the Middle Ages for an idea of two separate genders that will never mix. So how are people... Right.
How long have you got?
I know. Well, I mean, yeah, you did a whole series of both of these topics on The Public Medievalist. There's a whole book. But for now, how are people leaning on the Middle Ages to really kind of enforce an idea of two genders that are distinct and separate? How do they use chivalry, for example?
Well, it's a multi-part answer. And one of the simplest things to say is they try to use the Middle Ages to justify gender stereotypes that are actually fairly new and recent that actually come to us out of the Victorian era. So if you look at the medieval world, Chaucer is full of terrific examples. The stereotypes that they associate with men and women don't necessarily match what we think a man or a woman would be today. So men can cry. Medieval people considered men more intellectual and more spiritual, and they considered women much hornier, like much more into sex, much more animal, but also kind of cold and calculating. Chaucer's poem, Troilus and Cressida, you've got this sort of, it's a bit of a parody of a romance, right? You've got a sort of weepy, emotional, knightly hero, and then this very cold and calculating widow sort of manipulates him. But that's a very common thing that you see in medieval romance and in medieval poetry. And even in poems where church fathers tell men not to get married and to join the church instead, you know, they talk about how, like, sexual and irresponsible women are, and how, anyway, so those are bad stereotypes, like, but they're not the same as our bad stereotypes, where we think of men very much in the way that medieval people thought of women, and we think of women as sort of the moral center of the family, right, and the sort of pure and innocent and virginal. That comes about in sort of a long story, but people who promote modern day chivalry, what they tend to do is they look at very often 19th and early 20th century stories about the Middle Ages and pull out these ideas of an obedient man who protects women, right? And a docile, submissive woman who draws the man to her through her weakness. That is what 19th century people idealized in terms of gender. It also had a lot to do with whiteness. And it very much influences a lot of the medieval themed popular culture in the 20th and 21st centuries. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is, you know, the idea that there are only two, two genders, right? and that heterosexuality is normative. So a lot of extremist religious groups and even a lot of far right groups that are not tolerant of any kind of sexual variation will use the Middle Ages to say, well, you know, if you were anything outside of a heterosexual married partnership, then you would have been burned at the stake. And that's completely not true. I mean, if you look, for example, at Al-Andalus, which is early Spain when it was ruled by Muslims, I mean, there are just reams of poetry between men. There's evidence of same-sex female relationships, and there's evidence of a lot of the stuff in other cultures too. And Paul may want to pick up a little on evidence of transgender identities.
Sure, yeah. I mean, we actually do have evidence for people who were living as a gender other than the one that they were assigned at birth. I want to be very careful because it's not, because the idea of a transgender identity isn't necessarily something that had formed then. And I also really want to, doff my cap at the excellent work being done on this by Gabriel Bachowski and Roland Betancourt, particularly in this vein. But I think particularly there has been a tendency through the 19th and 20th century when people have looked at stories of people who did not live as the gender that they were assigned, whether they be in mythology or several that you get in, say, religious literature, for example. There's a whole bevy of saints whose stories effectively are that they were born female, but they lived as a man and as a monk, and were only discovered to be biologically female after their death. And that the scholarship on this over the course of the 19th and 20th century really painted these as cross-dressing, or impersonation of a woman. When in reality, now, I think that there's a very overdue reassessment of this being done that really looks at them as possible or probable trans people. Obviously, we can't necessarily assigning someone to be trans after their death in the same way that assigning someone to be cis after their death isn't necessarily right. But ignoring the fact that they lived as a gender other than what they were assigned at birth through their entire life, in spite of the fact that this in many cases caused them significant hardship to do so, means that there clearly was a very strong urge to do so. And that shouldn't be ignored.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's wise to be cautious about how we paint these people in terms of terms that we use that they never would have used. Mm. They may not have thought in the terms that we use now. So it's good to think of it, not label people, I think, with modern terms. But as you say, the choices that people make and how they live their lives seem to show that there aren't these stereotypes, these two little boxes that people fit in and had to stay in. And you do see that a lot in the book. So how is that being used in modern times to kind of, how are people using medievalism to reinforce these things? How are you seeing it in modern times?
So I've done a lot of work on phenomenon of purity balls.
I learned a lot.
Which is kind of a medieval themed prom where fathers bring their daughters to get them to promise to stay virgins until they get married. And it's full of medieval rituals, and the fathers sort of take vows, chivalric vows, to their daughters to promise to protect them and to protect their virginity. And they walk through archways of crossed swords and like leave roses at the feet of statues. And
yuck.
I will say that it tends to be a sort of radical fundamentalist Christianity that practices these balls, but they were very popular over the last decade for a long time, and they sort of crossed over into mainstream rituals. But there are a number of religions, evangelical Christianity, Catholicism, radical Islam, that see the chivalric, what they call the complementary relationship of the genders, as a sort of model for behavior. And in a lot of these faiths, any kind of movement away from what's seen as an ideal gender for a woman that's submissive and maternal, and for a man that's strong but obedient, any movement away from that and away from heterosexuality too is a deviant thing that needs to be punished, and the person needs to be brought back into line. And from the time that kids are very young, they often get medieval stories altered of how to behave in that way. One example that we use in the book and that I've used before is, you know, Edmund Leighton's painting The Accolade,
yeah,
where a woman is knighting the man kneeling at her feet. Doug Phillips, who ran Vision Family Forum, which is now defunct because Phillips wound up like sexually harassing his staff and having affairs, but he narrated and sold a CD about how to raise an obedient daughter. And on the cover, he photoshopped Leighton's painting so that the woman who used to be knighting the man is now kneeling beneath the man. So not only is the medievalism of that kind of thing filtered through the 19th century, like an early 20th century, but like the early 20th century, late 19th century is way too radical for them. It was way too feminist. They had to physically move the image of the woman so that she's positioned beneath the man.
Yeah, it's really awkward Photoshop. You have a picture in the book. Yes. It's really an awkward picture. Paul, did you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of times when we think about radical fundamentalist Christianity in the United States, we tend to think of the evangelical movement. But I think also one of the things that I looked into that shouldn't be ignored is also the ways in which this shows up in Catholicism now, that there is a significant, very fundamentalist Catholic movement that is rebelling against the reforms of Vatican II, particularly the reforms that were trying to make it more inclusive and get along better with other faiths. You'll find, you know, the same thing as you get in the evangelical world. And in fact, in a lot of cases, they have more in common with evangelical Protestants than they have with mainstream Catholics. And this is also where you get an intersection with the other big image of the Middle Ages that's used by the far right, and that is of the Crusader. The idea of that the image of the knight and the image of the Crusader in particular is very powerful and used powerfully, particularly by and among these Catholic groups, as a way of stoking and capitalizing upon Islamophobia to try to provoke their members towards political action or violent action.
Yeah, unfortunately, we are seeing crusade images. We're seeing crusader words. We're seeing images, names of people who had been on crusade, for example, that are being inscribed on weapons and things like that. These are literally being weaponized against people. So this is obviously something that we need to take care of. So what do you think is the best way for us as medievalists or people who love the medieval world? What is the best way for us to kind of move forward on this so that we can de-escalate the sort of violence and intolerance that we're seeing in the name of the Middle Ages?
Well, my first answer is a little sad to me because I'm out of the classroom now. But I think the classroom is one of the first places to start. And even in, you know, if you're a university professor, even in an early general education class, you can introduce students to a Middle Ages that doesn't match the narrative of crusade. You can introduce students to stories and poetry and historical evidence of people of different faiths getting along and practicing philosophy together and governing together.
Which is not ahistorical.
No, it's completely historical, right? And people getting along more often than they don't. That, first of all, is a way to disrupt that narrative of constant conflict and inevitable conflict and inevitable war that we see the far right promoting. That is one way to do it. Reaching out to the public in the way that public medievalists and a lot of scholars have done is another way to do it.
Yeah, and I think actually, and this is something that I've written a little bit about it on the Public Medievalist in the article that we published after the Charlottesville rally. And that is, and speaking to your listeners directly, is that, I mean, as a person who participated in reenactment groups like the SCA in the past, and even LARP groups and things like that, that those groups seem to be very fertile recruiting grounds for the far right. We've seen far right individuals who overlap their interest in the Middle Ages with these groups fairly commonly. And I remember back in my, you know, my time in these groups, that I remember there being, you know, there were a few people who had weird politics, and we didn't talk about it, and we did sort of live and let live kind of thing. And I think it's important not to live and let live, to understand the damage that these people are doing, to understand that these people are recruiting in these groups, to understand that the way that the Middle Ages have been used so commonly in order to promote these ideologies means that you have to work extra hard and be extra vigilant to ensure that they do not have a foothold in communities who are of this interest. So I would implore you, be vigilant. Educate yourself, educate the people around you who are interested in the Middle Ages, and ensure that these groups have zero tolerance policies when it comes to people who are espousing racist, sexist, toxic views of the Middle Ages.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Yeah, and I would see, you know, correcting things is important. And at the same time, it's important to create stories, right? If you're a creative type, which I'll bet a lot of your listeners are, it's important to explore the Middle Ages so that you can create alternate stories and can look at a diverse Middle Ages and a feminist Middle Ages and a Middle Ages that doesn't match the narrative and give people hope in the past. Because I think that for too long, there's been a sense that people who want to find justification for war and violence and abuse look backward, and people who want to find justification for peace and humanity and liberation have to look forward. And I don't think that's necessarily true, right? Because medieval people had a lot of the same conflicts and needs and desires as we did, and looking back at them and telling those stories can give us a sense of continuity and a sense of hope that these things are possible. So it's not just about protecting the past and saying, you know, you're wrong, it wasn't like this, even though that's a huge part of what we have to do. But it's also about opening it up, you know, opening up the gates and showing people what's there and letting them play there in productive and creative ways.
Yeah, I think that's so right. I think I'm just like totally on board with everything that the two of you are saying. So give us some recommendations. Where do you see some creative stuff that if people want to support a Middle Ages that looks like the actual Middle Ages, that has some tolerance for everybody, what do you recommend? Where do you guys read and play that you think is really good that you'd recommend to people?
So I can give you a whole list of fantasy writers that I love.
Give me your favorite.
The podcast knows that favorite is too hard. I can tell you a couple off the top of my head. S.A. Sure. Chakraborty, her Empire of Brass and Gold. It's a whole trilogy. Tasha Suri is another good one. Oh, I'm on the spot now. Saladin Ahmed is another one. So those three, for example, Evan Winter, are writing fantasy about a more global Middle Ages and a more humane and diverse Middle Ages, for example.
Yeah, and I've been playing a lot of video games recently. That's how I've been getting through quarantine myself. Crusader Kings 3 came out, despite the very not they need to they really need to redo that name.
Yeah.
But one of the really interesting things about Crusader Kings 3 is both that it reflects a global Middle Ages, one that doesn't necessarily center Europe, so you can play as someone from Africa. You can play as someone from Asia. I think the map goes all the way. It includes India. It includes, I think, much of China. And it includes the sort of top half of Africa. And you can play as any of those people that you like. And they also have options for if you want to play with more gender equality, that they have options for that. They have options for that that you can just toggle in the settings. Because if you want to just have it be more gender parity, then click. There you go. You're good to go. But even more than that, you can forge a Middle Ages because, you know, in the game, you're playing the ruler of your kingdom or your queendom. And you can do kind of whatever you like. And so you can actually change the laws such that there is more gender parity. And you can change the religious laws such that it is more accepting of homosexuality and things like that. And so you can make the Middle Ages what you want. And also, more interestingly, the thing that I really like about that game particularly is it's not perfect in terms of its politics, but I think that just the degree of diversity that it shows across the entire medieval world, these parts of the world that people probably had never heard of. I mean, there are places in the world that I had never heard of. And people's stories represented there that I never knew existed. And so I've been really enjoying delving into that and finding out more and more and more, and that there's more and more to know than we thought.
That is so good to hear. I'm not a big video game person, but I know just how influential they are in terms of bringing people to history and fantasy novels, for sure. These are two big grounds for where you find people that love the Middle Ages. And so I'm so happy to hear that they are starting to actually have a more diverse cast of characters. And actually that the fantasy world is accepting not only diverse characters, but diverse creators, which I think is something that is brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And that's an integral part of it, right? You can't just have a bunch of white people continually doing the writing, or you're going to have a Middle Ages that looks the same, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I think the one thing I think I want to see more of are the people with the big money. You know, we want to see Netflix, we want to see the TV, we want to see TV, we want to see more films that represent diverse people in the Middle Ages and diverse stories from the Middle Ages, not just focusing on the same five kings that we've seen stories of, you know, same, yet another Robin Hood, yet another King Arthur. I want to see more stories by the people with the big budgets. I think that's really the next step in all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we are moving towards change. And I'm really, really hopeful. And I'm hoping that the work that you guys have done on The Public Medievalist and this book are really going to get that ball rolling. So thank you so much for coming to talk to me about this. We could talk about this forever, but we should probably wrap it up. So thanks so much, guys, for joining me.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
Amy and Paul's book is called The Devil's Historians, and it's now available everywhere for reading at home or in the classroom. You can follow Amy on Twitter at Dr. Dark Age, and you can follow Paul on Twitter at past_present. I'd also encourage you to check out the articles at The Public Medievalist, especially the series on race and racism, as well as the one on gender and sexism. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's going on, Peter?
Hey. Well, this week we have Gillian Pollack. She's talking about two novelists you probably heard of, Maurice Druon and George R. R. Martin, and how she sees them as kind of two sides of the same coin. So we've got that piece. Then Elizabeth Smith Rosser takes us to 11th century China to tell us the tale of Jing Zong of Xia, the upstart king. So we also have part three at our look at Robin Hood. And we have some news about places to see both in person and virtually. So all that and more.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. A lot of new and exciting stuff going on. It's like it's a whole new school year.
Yes, people are getting active. And yeah, it's nice to see everyone kind of getting back into the medieval studying spirit.
Yeah, I love it. Well, thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. It's an exciting time to be a patron of the Medieval Podcast, since we have so much to offer, from magazine subscriptions to our monthly book club, and now exclusive maps by Tina Ross. But even if you can only kick in a dollar, it's your support that keeps this all going, so you have my utmost gratitude. All the action is at patreon.com/medievalists. For historians on the side of the angels and content for everyone, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter at medievalists. You can follow me, Danielle Sabalski, on social media at 5minmedievalist, and you can find my books at all your favorite stores. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening and for making medieval studies a welcoming place for everyone.